Blog Talk Radio. Tonight's Literary New England radio show features an hour of lively conversations with three diverse authors who've written three unforgettable books. Today is Monday, June 15th. I'm your host, Cindy Wolf Boynton, and tonight I talk with Cy Montgomery about her memoir, The Soul of an Octopus, a surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness. It's a touching, entertaining, and really a profound memoir that explores the emotional and physical world of the octopus and the remarkable connections it's able to make with humans. And when you talk with Cy, you learn a lot, such as using the word octopi is not correct.
Interestingly, it is not the plural. I always grew up thinking it was, and I love the word. But it is actually octopuses, because you can't put a Latin ending, I, on a Greek word.
I also talk with Jean Zimmerman about Savage Girl, the story of a wealthy and outlandish Manhattan couple who adopt a girl, purportedly raised by wolves, with the grand idea of civilizing and introducing her into the high society of the Gilded Age in New York City.
I've lived in or near the city all my life. I just think that New York City is the best place in the world.
My third guest, Charles Dubow, will also be tonight's first interview. Charles, who is a graduate of Connecticut's Wesleyan University, is the author of Girl in the Moonlight. It's his second novel. It's also on the top of countless summer must-read lists. And as you'll hear during our conversation, it's a book that was written by a man who feels that in his new career as an author, he's been given not just a gift, but it's come at a time that's absolutely right for where he is in life.
One of the advantages of having the chance to actually write at my age is that I have the enthusiasm of a younger writer, combined with the maturity and the experience of somebody who is now actually 52 years old.
Most simply put, though it is by no means a simple novel, Girl in the Moonlight is a steamy tale about one man's all-consuming desire for a beautiful, bewitching, and beguiling woman.
I kind of work from the premise that everybody has a first love in their life, which we never really forget completely, and these are either, you know, these are people that we meet when we're obviously quite young, and for good or ill, they kind of shape kind of how we regard love and relationships for the rest of our lives, and often in the case of first loves, these are people that we probably really shouldn't have been with anyway, and so we tend to kind of move on. And of course, there are exceptions where you kind of, the first person you fall in love with is in fact the right best person for you, and then you are lucky enough if you, you know, to actually stay with them. But in this case, the first love of the character Wiley is a young woman named Cheska, who he meets when he is 10 years old and she is 12, and he just falls for her. And he is never really able to let go of her. And she knows that. And like a lot of people, you know, who are the object of love, it's very flattering to them, but they don't always necessarily behave the way that they should. And it's all about kind of how their relationship kind of evolves and changes over the years, and kind of how they eventually grow up. And so it kind of starts with them again when they are kids and ends in their 30s.
So the book is set in several different locations. It's set on the East Coast. It also takes us over to Europe.
Yep.
I hope you were able to take a field trip to Europe while you were working on this book.
Well, I mean, I did not need to. I actually lived in London at the end of the 1980s, so I know London quite well. The parts of it are set in Venice, so I've been to Venice a couple of times. I kind of know, the places that I actually wrote about. And as far as, where most of the action is set, which is on Long Island, it's a place where I basically, spend every summer for the first 40 or so years of my life. So, it's a place that is, that I know very well, and also it's a place that has begun to gradually kind of disappear and change. I mean, as I was saying before, the Hamptons that I knew when I was a child are not the Hamptons that people think of today. It was not the kind of glamorous, jet-setty kind of thing that it's become. It was much more laid back. You had a lot of artists who lived out there. You had a lot of writers who lived out there. You had a lot of people who didn't have really a lot of money who lived out there, but actually could live quite well. And so you had still the beautiful beaches, and you had the vegetables and the seafood and all the kind of things that people love about being out there, but it just hadn't quite kind of become as much of a scene as it is today.
Yes, and it is very much a scene, but it's a beautiful scene. I'm curious. You mentioned that you're in midlife, but you haven't always been a writer, have you?
No. I haven't always been a writer. I mean, when I was younger,
you
I wanted to
been
be
a published
a painter.
Writer.
I'm one of those people who I guess are lucky or cursed, depending on how you look at it, to have a certain amount of talent at drawing. And so, as a child, I really liked to draw. I was very good at it. People would say, "Wow, you're really good, Charles." Because of living out in the Hamptons, I was able to meet a lot of painters, like real painters. And so I just kind of fell in love with the idea of becoming a painter. And I thought, wow, this is the way to live your life. And then, as I began to kind of dip my toe in the water in the art world in the 1980s, I kind of had kind of a rude awakening when I realized that the idealized concept that I had of the art world was not what it really was like. And so I kind of turned away from painting. But I guess I still had a creative itch to scratch. So I turned to actually writing instead. I tried to write a novel when I was in my 20s. It didn't go anywhere. Then I kind of wound up, getting married and having children and went to work and didn't really have a chance to really write for a long time. And, but I was in the magazine business, so I kind of was able to still kind of use my interests in first being as a journalist and then being an editor. So I mean it was something that I enjoyed very much. But when I got to in my late 40s, I decided that I had to give it one more shot at actually trying to write a book. And so I wrote Indiscretion over the course of a couple of years. I just didn't have any time. I did have a full-time job, and so I have to wake up every morning at 5 in the morning to write for a couple of hours until I had to get my kids ready to go to school. When that came out, I was obviously thrilled, and it kind of now I'm able to do it full-time.
That's fabulous. And actually, I remember reading Indiscretion shortly after it came out. And I loved it. I truly loved it. In fact, I remember very clearly because there was so much red on the cover. I don't know, that's one of the random reasons why it stands out so much in my mind, but I it was one of those books that I just couldn't put down, and I would bring it, I brought it to work with me, and I would try to have it, like, open very discreetly on my desk, so if I had a slow moment,
right.
I could I could turn it, I could read a couple of pages, and I remember one of the things that struck me about it was, it was, aside from being just a great story, I remember thinking to myself that this was written by a mature writer. This was written by someone who not just has a way with words, but who has lived for a while.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that is one of the advantages of having the chance to actually write at my age is that I have the like enthusiasm of a younger writer combined with the maturity and the experience of somebody who is now actually 52 years old. So I feel like I'm making up for lost time in many ways. I mean, it's very exciting for me to be able to do this. I've just completed another manuscript. So I feel like, I guess also one of the good things about having been a journalist for so long is that, you know, you learn how to write under a deadline. You know, you can't afford to kind of waste time and kind of stare at the blank page or the blank computer screen for too long, and you just have to kind of get down to it and write. And so I do that. I mean, I'm lucky to be extremely disciplined. So, and because I feel like I've got so much inside of me that I want to still get out while I can, you know, I'm just, you know, writing, you know, all the time. And it's been, you know, it's been wonderful. And I guess one of the best things is that it's actually allowed me to actually move out of New York, city where I was born and raised and, you know, lived for years and years and years, to Washington, Connecticut, where I'm just, you know, I just love being up here in, Litchfield County. It's a wonderful part of the world. My kids have a great time. My wife adores it. It's just been a wonderful move. So, and also for the first time in my life, I have a real office where I can actually sit and work, and it's dark and quiet, and it's I'm very, very lucky, and I just hope that people like my new book, you know, so that would be kind of, then it just kind of gives me a reason to kind of keep on going.
Well, I think a couple of people like it because it's gotten very good reviews, and I know it was chosen as one of Amazon's best book of May in literature and fiction. That's got to be exciting for you.
It's very exciting. I feel so lucky and so blessed, and you know, I mean, to finally be able to do what I've always wanted to do, and to feel that people like what I'm writing. You know, I mean, you can't ask for anything better. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're a writer or a cook or a lawyer or a, you know, anyone. You know, when people appreciate what you do and when you love what you do, I mean, it's just very sweet.
It doesn't get better than that. Charles, I know that you don't have a website. You do have a Facebook page. Is that the best place for fans to reach out to you at?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you tweet at all?
I do. I have a Twitter account, and I tweet from time to time. Afraid I'm less of a tweeter than I am a Facebooker. But... And it's funny. I've had a Twitter account for, I mean, I don't know, I mean, almost 10 years now, I haven't really ever kind of gotten into it as much as I have with Facebook. I think part of the fun is that Facebook is much more of visual, you know. So you have all the pictures,
yes.
And that's just kind of fun. So I like that. But you know, no, it's. But if people want to reach out to me on my Facebook page, that'd be great.
Wonderful. And Charles, we need to wrap things up. But A Girl in the Moonlight. What do you hope that people are going to see or experience or feel from reading it?
Well, I think really the takeaway that I'm hoping people will have is that it's important to realize, it's about what's the best way to actually lead our lives? How do we actually choose the right paths to take? how do we know when we've done something wrong or need to kind of change our course, and how do we, when we've done something wrong, how do we actually redeem ourselves? I mean, it's really a big question for me in terms of, and I guess I can kind of draw on that in my own life. You know, I feel like, you know, I mean, to kind of contradict F. Scott Fitzgerald's famous line about how there are no second acts in American lives, I'd like to say that there is one in mine, and I think there is one in my characters as well.
Charles, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this. This was a lot of fun.
Win a copy of Girl in the Moonlight by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Literary New England recently reviewed Girl in the Moonlight, which you can see on our blog, www.LitNewEngland.com. Check out our blog site when you have a few minutes. You'll find lots of great and quirky book news and information there, along with book giveaways. And actually, I love giving away books so much, let's give away some copies of Savage Girl while I talk with Jean Zimmerman about this fantastic novel. It was recently released in paperback, giving Savage Girl a rebirth day, something that I find really exciting and wondered whether Jean found exciting also.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's wonderful to see it in a form that I think more people will be able to see it and read it in. I know for myself, I pick up books in soft cover that I wouldn't in hardcover. So it's fantastic, and I just want more people to be exposed to it.
How come? Why do you love this book so much?
Well, I just love the whole idea of this mysterious sideshow waif, this feral child from out west who comes to the Gilded Age in New York to be groomed as a high society debutante. I mean, I just think it's a Pygmalion story that we all somehow still resonate to.
So tell us about the story. What is the Savage Girl all about?
Okay, she's, well, as I said, she's from way out west. She's seen in a sideshow by a very wealthy couple from New York City who are out in Nevada to inspect their silver mines. And they catch a glimpse of her in this sideshow, this kind of seedy sideshow, and they decide that they want to raise her up as a debutante, that she's going to be sort of their pet project, and they're going to see how that works. And, of course, murder and mayhem follow her wherever she goes, so it's not as easy a process as they think it's going to be.
So where did this story idea come from?
Well, you know, I had always wanted to write a story about a wolf child, that is one afflicted with the genetic condition known as hypertrichosis, which causes a person to resemble an animal in the sense that they have fur growing all over their body. And there used to be many people with this condition, many children exhibited in sideshows in America in an earlier period. So that somehow got crossed in my mind with this phenomenon of feral children, a girl or a boy who is purported to be raised by wolves or sometimes by bears or cats or goats or, you know, somebody claimed to be raised by rats. And I ultimately melded these two ideas together as a foundation for Savage Girl.
Okay, I get the whole wolves thing and a lot of other animals, but rats?
I know, it's crazy. I mean, you know, Willard, it's hard to think. But people kind of come out of the woodwork and they claim to have had this experience. And for some reason, I think that fascinates people, the idea of being raised sort of outside your own species. And it's happened many times throughout history.
So similar to The Orphan Master, which was your last novel before Savage Girl, it's set in New York City. Mm-hmm. Why this location?
Well, I love New York City. I've lived in or near the city all my life, and I've written about the city before in nonfiction. With these two novels, I've given myself permission, I think, to invent around the edges of history and to use all that I know and all that I research, and yet to give it a different kind of life. So I just think that New York City is the best place in the world. And the more we know of its history, the more fascinating it is.
Yeah, it really is. And actually, I'm scrolling through your website as we're talking, and you put some really neat articles about, well, related both to The Orphan Master and particularly about Savage Girl, about history, some photographs, things that you found about other feral children and, you know, what Central Park was like at the time this novel is set. You really take us behind the scenes of this book.
Well, you know, I learned so much in doing the research for this period, which was 1875, just after the Civil War. And a lot of things were going on then, but New York hadn't quite reached the state that we think of it now. Things like the Statue of Liberty, what hadn't been erected yet. There was just its arm being raised in one of the parks to show people what the Statue of Liberty was going to be like when it was built. And Grand Central Station, what we think of now, was then an earlier incarnation that had just been built. It was brand new, and yet there was cattle herded down 42nd Street on the way to the stockyards. So it had one foot in the past, and yet, you know, there were more millionaires per capita than anywhere else in the world. So it was a kind of balance between these two things, between the old and the new, and the sort of the very, very wealthy and the people that didn't have anything. And I thought that was really interesting.
So I'm trying to get the visual. I have the visual actually right now of the cows coming down.
Right.
42nd Street.
Right.
And I'm probably going to be thinking about that all day now. But I'm curious, you've done such intense research, and I know how exciting and fun research can be, and it's so easy to just get lost in all the research that you never actually start writing anything. So I'm curious, how did you handle that with Savage Girl?
Well, I don't experience it that way, really. What I find is that when I'm having trouble writing, I go back to research, and that sort of helps me get going again, the inspiration of the research and of what I'm finding out. So that's what makes me want to write. I mean, I love the research, but telling the story is so much fun, too, that, you know, when we write, as I write historical fiction, and it's history, yes, but the fiction is really paramount, and I always have that in my mind.
So you don't get lost in the whole research part?
Well, I get lost in my mind, yes, but no, it doesn't keep me from writing the book. I find that it just inspires me.
So how did you, but to start Savage Girl, did you have to do a lot of research about the time period and these feral children?
Yeah, and you know, I really wear out my library card. You know, I do a lot of research. I do some Wikipedia, yes. But what I find is that I have a really intimate relationship with my library and interlibrary loan, and there's just so much out there that there's a lot that's sitting on the shelf that's kind of dusty, actually, that I feel like I'm the only one in the last 50 years that has taken this book out. But, so I do a lot of research to begin, and then as I'm going along, I find these holes that have to be plugged or things that need to be that I'm thinking about that I need to have a better idea about, so that I can write about, say, you know, a lot of this book is about the debutante process in that era, which I loved and I learned about. But then as I went on, I wanted to learn more about things like what exactly the dresses looked like, what the jewelry looked like, you know, what people, you know, women, they went on visits to each other, many visits, sometimes 20 visits a day during the debutante, during the coming out process, and they would bring these little calling cards. And so I was able to find out exactly what these calling cards looked like and what they said on them. And that was something that I did as I was going along. So I thought that those details were really crucial. And sometimes I didn't know until I was writing what I needed.
So you've gotten wonderful reviews for Savage Girl. Has that been very exciting for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always sort of amazed, like, wow, they really got it. It's so wonderful as a writer to have your work out there and have people reading it. It's always sort of an honor to have that happen. So yeah, I'm really very pleased.
And now, will the paperback release take you on any kind of tour, any events or signings?
Oh, it's really more web-based than that because I've already done that other stuff.
Sure.
So if I, you know, if I have, I will do events, but I'm really, to be honest with you, I'm focusing on what happens next to some extent. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I'm guessing that you have another novel either almost done or totally done.
I've actually been working on a nonfiction book, so that's a little bit different. Yeah, on a work of history that focuses on this very exciting female explorer in America in 1830. So, but it's nonfiction, as I said. But I'm able to dredge up all those juicy details that I liked so much in Savage Girl and The Orphan Master.
That's fabulous. Can you tell us her name, or is it a secret?
No, her name is Fanny Trollope, and she was actually the mother of Anthony Trollope, the novelist. She was just an extraordinary woman who wrote one of the first bestsellers, a travel book that was a bestseller in England and America.
I love her name, if nothing else, Fanny Trollope.
Right. It is a great name.
That's exciting. That's exciting. And what about fiction? Do you have any more novels in the works or thinking about when you're done with this book?
I have a few things percolating, but not really ready to see air yet.
Okay. So someone who is just looking for, you know, a great book to throw in their beach bag or, you know, to kind of roll up and throw somewhere, which they can do now with The Savage Girl. I love paperbacks because, like you said, they're so very portable.
Yeah.
Why should they consider this novel of yours?
Well, it's sort of got a lot of different things. It's got this wild quality, so it's got a kind of fantastic quality. It's historical. It's got crime. It's got romance. It's sort of got all these things rolled up together. So I think it's an exciting read, and I have been recommending it to people that really like historical crime fiction more than anything else.
And I have to tell you, I like the hardcover cover, but I love the paperback cover.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very sexy.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
Thanks.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was great to be here. Thank you.
So far, we've given you chances to win Charles Dubos' Girl in the Moonlight and Jean Zimmerman's Savage Girl. If you haven't yet, send a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. It's not too late. Do it now for either of these books or to win a copy of Cy Montgomery's The Soul of an Octopus, a surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness. Cy is also the author of the related children's book, The Octopus Scientists, Exploring the Mind of a Mollusk. She and I talked about these titles.
The first one, which is called The Soul of an Octopus, I began researching in March 2011 when I met my first octopus, Athena. And I went to the New England Aquarium where a keeper opened the tank and I asked, "Can I touch the octopus?" Well, the octopus came right over to meet me. She turned bright red with excitement, looked me in the eye, and her arms came boiling out to meet my hands. And I put my hands in the 47-degree water and started stroking her, and dozens of her suckers connected to the skin of my hands and arms, and we were communing. It was so cool. And it was striking because actually, I was told that she hadn't done that with a person that she didn't know before. And I very much felt that she was as curious about me as I was about her. And that's where this long 3-year odyssey with octopuses began. And the children's book, The Octopus Scientists, is about a particular expedition, one expedition that I went on also as part of The Soul of an Octopus, to Moria in French Polynesia with octopus scientists. So the whole octopus odyssey, which went on for years and actually continues to this day, because I'm working with New England Aquarium to redesign their octopus tanks. So this octopus odyssey may never end. But it brought me so many things, including I learned to scuba dive because I so wanted to be with these animals in the water. And I went to Mexico to meet wild octopuses and to French Polynesia with these wonderful scientists. So that's what the two books are. The younger version is illustrated with gorgeous, gorgeous underwater photographs by Keith Ellenbogen, and it's for grades 4 through 8. That's a large age range because about half of the book is photographs, and even kids who find reading a challenge will love this book because of the fabulous pictures that will draw you in to the story. And the story is the true adventure of trying to study octopuses in the wild with this international team from Brazil and from Alaska and from Canada.
So are you like an octopus whisperer?
Well, I wish I were. I think I got along well with the octopuses I met because I think they could tell I was not afraid, and I knew how to touch them in a way that they liked. Their skin is like electric. Did you read just yesterday? Actually, I knew about this before it was published in the larger press, but just yesterday a report came out from Roger Hanlon's lab that they can see with their skin, that they have optics.
What?
Yes, they can detect light with their skin. They also, and this has been well known, can taste with all of their skin, including their eyelids, although it's most exquisitely developed in the suckers. And that was why, you know, it was such an intimate thing the first time I met my first octopus to have somebody, you know, hugging and squeezing and tasting you. If this had happened with a person on first meeting, I would have found that alarming, but I didn't since it was an octopus.
Isn't that fascinating?
It's pretty cool.
That is really cool. So now, how long have you been a writer, Cy?
My first book was published in 1991, but before that, of course, I was a professional journalist. I wrote for daily papers in college, and in high school, I wrote for a weekly paper.
And your books really have focused around animals.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? You've written about tigers and dolphins and bears and birds.
Right.
Was it just that one meeting of that octopus that took you into the ocean?
Well, then after the one meeting, I was hooked. And so I came back and back and back after just 3 visits with Athena. Unfortunately, you know, octopuses don't live very long. They only live 3 to 5 years. These giant, the longest lived ones are the giant Pacific octopus. There's 250 species of octopus, and they live all over the world. But the giant Pacific probably lives the longest, and they live 5 years at most. And by the time you meet an octopus in an aquarium, they're already, you know, a year or maybe 2 years old. And so Athena died just after 3 meetings with her. But I met her successor, and I met the successor to that octopus and the successor to that one and got to know them all very well. And, you know, the whole time you're getting to know them, you're falling in love with that individual, but you're also falling in love with this alien species that can, with all these superpowers that we don't have, you know, they can squeeze through a tiny opening, they can pour their bodies through a tiny crack, they have no bones at all. You know, they can see and taste with their skin. They have venom like a snake. They can shoot ink. They can change color and shape. And they're unbelievable creatures. So unlike us, and yet there's a point at which there can be a meeting of the minds. And so I was just crazy about them. And that was what made me want to learn to scuba dive. And this, of course, opened the whole ocean to me. I called myself a naturalist for half a century, but didn't ever really explore anything but the very edges of what is most of the planet, the ocean.
So birds and pigs and even dolphins, I'm guessing, are fairly easy to find close to home, which for you is New England. Where do you find these octopuses?
Well, happily, right in Boston was where I did most of my research with captive octopuses. And that's the good thing for the listening public, is that you too can get to know an octopus, because they will look through the glass and they do recognize individual humans. And it's not just me saying this. This is well known by keepers, and experiments have proved it. But if you want to dive in the wild and find octopuses, this is hard to do, because they can camouflage, because they can hide. I know lots of scuba divers who've spent their entire career scuba diving and never seen an octopus. So when I went to Mexico on my first dives, happily, our dive master also loved octopuses, and octopus kind of became the theme of our group's dives. And so we looked for octopuses on every dive. Usually what you look for is their midden pile outside of the den. They eat all kinds of things. They'll eat everything. They've been known, giant Pacific octopuses have been known to eat otters and birds. But
what?
Yes, they can grab birds out of the sky. And I don't know if the otter that was being eaten by an octopus had already been found dead. I mean, nobody knows what happened, but they will eat them. An octopus will eat anything it can, and also octopuses will be eaten by anything that can eat them, which is probably why they're so smart, you know, because they have to know how a wide variety of prey items might behave and how such a wide variety of predators might behave. But anyway, when you're looking for an octopus in the wild, often you don't look for an octopus, because what does an octopus look like? Well, the answer is anything it wants, because it can change color and shape, it can change its posture, it can change the texture of its skin, and it can pour itself into the tiniest little crack in the coral. So what you look for is its garbage heap, essentially, the remains of a meal. And what octopuses do that almost no one else does is, if they've eaten a scallop or clams, they pile the shells one on top of the other, like you would pile dishes in the sink, and they leave it outside of their den. So that's what you look for.
Now, are there any in the waters off of New England?
There are, but they're pretty deep, and it's very, I wouldn't recommend looking for them there. It's very hard to find them. The only reason we know they're there is that every once in a while one shows up in bycatch, you know, as you're catching something else, and here's an octopus that you didn't want to catch. They are in Florida, though. There's different kinds of octopus that you can see in Florida. The best place, though, I'd advise the public to look for them would be in your local aquarium, because most big aquaria have octopuses. It is thought, you know, they call them the plum and the plum pudding that is the aquarium. You don't really want to have an aquarium without an octopus, because they're just such exciting, charismatic animals. And pretty much invariably in aquariums, most fish don't have names, but octopuses always do, because they're
really
such individuals. At Seattle Aquarium, they had one named Emily Dickinson because she was so shy, and another named Leisure Suit Larry because he was so bold and his arms were all over you. And they had another named Lucretia McEvil because she would dismantle her tank. They're very distinctive in their personalities. And so was the case with the ones that I knew at New England Aquarium. The first one, Athena, had been named after the goddess of war and wisdom because she was a feisty, smart octopus, not at all like her laid-back predecessor, who was actually, there were three males before her. And then as soon as I showed up, all the octopuses we got started being female. Don't know why that was, but it was lucky, because I got to watch one of them, Octavia, tend her hundreds of thousands of eggs. And although the eggs were infertile, she didn't know that, at least not at first, and it was fascinating to watch her constantly tending these eggs. They lay eggs at the end of their lives, and if they're lucky, they live long enough to see them hatch if their eggs are fertile. But they hole up in their den, and in the wild, they don't even eat. They don't go hunting. All they do is take care of those eggs, guarding them, aerating them, fluffing them, cleaning them. And it's quite the process. Really cool to watch.
Huh. Isn't that fascinating? And so now, why weren't any of the eggs fertile?
Well, we had gotten Octavia from the wild. She was certainly an adult, but she was probably not mated. I mean, however, there is a steamy sex scene in the soul of the octopus, in which I did get to see two giant Pacific octopuses mate. And wow, it was great. I mean, it was very moving, it was exciting, it was erotic. Here's these two animals with, you know, eight arms. Each one of them has three hearts, so you're having six hearts beating as one. And you would think that with so many arms and so many suckers, it would offer a Kama Sutra of possibilities, which it sort of does. But one of the possibilities when you see octopuses mate is that one might eat the other, which happens
what?
Not infrequently. Yeah, it's a dinner date, but not the kind you want to go on.
That is hysterical. So the soul of an octopus, in this memoir, you take us where?
Well, we start at the New England Aquarium. And we meet four octopuses in succession. We get to know them. And we also get to know what it's like to learn scuba. We go to Cozumel, Mexico to meet wild octopuses. And we go to Seattle Aquarium to see octopuses mate. We also go to French Polynesia with a group of octopus scientists looking into the mind of an octopus and study what a different species of octopus eats and why. And then we come back to the aquarium. And the cool thing was, well, there was a lot of cool things about octopuses, but while I was doing this book about an animal that is, you know, they are the queens of transformation, right? Because they can change their color, their shape, their skin texture. While this was going on, it's transforming me and my life, and the aquarium was undergoing the most dramatic transformation since it was built, in that they were rebuilding the central pillar of the aquarium, the giant ocean tank. So things were changing rapidly all around us. And it's also a story of the people that I met at New England Aquarium, who are their own special, quirky breed of fish whisperers. And these are folks that can see eels dreaming. They can smell fish stress. They can tame anacondas and teach tricks to blind and deaf toads. These are amazing people. So it's also the story of the people as well.
That is just fascinating. And now, in this book, that title, The Soul of an Octopus, did you choose that title because there was something you wanted us specifically to understand about these animals?
Yes, absolutely. I picked that title because most of us don't think of mollusks, you know, the octopus is a mollusk, like a clam or a snail, as having a soul. And many folks don't even think of other animals as having a soul. We think it's just an exclusively human thing. But the thing is, and what I learned, is that these animals are not only very intelligent, but they're very emotional. And I don't claim to know exactly what a soul is, because people debate this. Some say that, you know, it's the I, that, you know, the me, the self that watches the movie, the internal movie of our thoughts. Other people say the soul is the fingerprint of God. But I very much felt, in getting to know these octopuses as individuals and befriending them, that if I have a soul, an octopus has one too.
That's very beautiful.
Oh, I'm so glad you think that.
And I have to tell you, I feel very guilty now that for ever eating an octopus.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to encourage people to eat them, but octopuses eat octopuses. So in eating them, you didn't do anything that another octopus wouldn't do. But I don't eat them either. Actually, I've been a vegetarian for 30 years. So, but it does seem, once you know who an octopus is, that to have that particular taste on your palate until the next course comes is kind of a waste of a smart, intelligent being. But like I say, I mean, a lot of octopus matings end with one eating the other. There was one account of a female who mated with this male 12 times, but then 13 was unlucky and she ate him.
I'm so glad it was her that ate him and not him that ate her.
I know. Well, you want the one who can lay the eggs to survive. And
oh,
so she did.
That is true. Si, we've kind of been talking all over the place, but it's just so fascinating to talk with you. But we do need to wrap things up. So you have these two wonderful new books out, The Soul of an Octopus and The Octopus Scientist. And you're also doing appearances in support of them, which seem to be very concisely listed on your website.
Yes. I would love to have folks come out and meet me. If they want to go to simontgomery.com and go to appearances, come out and let me show you some incredible images of these animals and tell you more about octopuses.
Any chance that you bring a touch tank along with you?
Oh, geez, if only I could. It's very hard to ship them.
Si, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, I just loved it. Thank you.
I so hope that Si and my paths cross sometime soon. Wasn't she fabulous? I just loved talking with her. And actually, if you're in New Hampshire, you can meet her in person this week. On Thursday, June 18th, Si will be at Gibson's Bookstore, which is on Main Street in Concord, New Hampshire. She'll be there at 7 o'clock. She's going to speak about the two new books and signed copies. And then later on Tuesday, July 7th, she'll be at the Wilton Library in Wilton, New Hampshire, also at 7 o'clock. If you go see Si, please tweet me a picture. Send it to @LitNewEngland. I'd love to retweet it and maybe post it onto our blog. And you should check back on our blog regularly, where very shortly you'll see that on the next Literary New England Radio Show, we'll feature Sarah Benwell on The Last Leaves Falling, Heidi Pitlore on The Daylight Marriage, Chantal Acevedo on The Distant Marvels, and Jennifer Soon on Mayumi and the Sea of Happiness. But let's not leave tonight too soon. I want to make sure that I thank tonight's guests. So thank you, Si Montgomery, Gene Zimmerman, and Charles DeBow. Such a pleasure. Thanks to all of you also for listening. Until next week, have a great week and great reading.